Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, writer Tommy Orange talks about his critically acclaimed novel, There, There, which tells the story of urban Indians, people navigating their Native American heritage while living far away from any reservation community. Orange himself is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma, but he grew up in Oakland, California, often surrounded by people who could only conceive of American Indians as a relic of the past. We'll talk with Orange about the shattering prologue that he wrote to familiarize non-Native readers with the history they weren't taught in school, and about the ways he relates personally to the characters he created for this book. Our conversation starts after a short break. Any of us who we are? Is it our DNA? Is it the culture that surrounds us? Are we defined by who we long to be? And if our identity is something we have to figure out from other people like us, is it real? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Novelist Tommy Orange is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. But like most of the characters in his debut novel, he grew up in Oakland, California, a place where people of Native heritage make up less than 1% of the population. The thing is, the idea that American Indians mostly live on reservations is just wrong. The Department of Health and Human Services estimates 60% of Native Americans, nearly 4 million of them, now live in metropolitan areas. The 12 central characters in Orange's book, They're There, inhabit those urban and Native identities, shaped by history but very much part of contemporary America in 12 very distinct ways. Tommy Orange joins us now to talk about the book. Tommy, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with this amazing prologue that no one can read your book without commenting on the prologue, and you sort of divine centuries of history into 11 pages, and I can't even imagine sitting down knowing that was your challenge. How did you decide what to include and how to write that?
Well, it started with just the idea that people don't know about the fact that Native people live in cities, or, you know, a lot of us do, and there's a name for it that is used within the community, urban Indian, maybe less so now. I think Indians starting to, Native seems to be the more normal thing that people say now. So to even start talking about what an urban Indian is, I felt like I needed to sort of give it, all the characters needed context, and Native people ended up in cities because of relocation, which started in the 50s and 60s, and relocation was part of the Indian termination policy, which is a genocidal policy. And to start getting into that, you have to go back into history. And because there's such a history of it being told wrong or sort of romanticized, I just wanted to, I don't know, rewrite it in a way that not only contextualized what an urban Indian is, but sort of goes back into some of the darker aspects of this country's origins.
Has it always bothered you that people don't recognize that there are lots of Native people living in cities? The majority of Native Americans live in cities.
I don't know if it's generally bothersome to feel invisible, yeah, or to feel like when you do say that you are Native, generally the response is either they question how much you are and what makes you a qualified one, or they'll say, and this comes up all the time, they'll say, oh, so the government gives you money. And this is a very common thing that people,
really,
say. They immediately go to,
what this, are you getting free?
Yeah, this fake idea that all of us are individually wealthy from the government because the government feels so bad, but it clearly doesn't.
Yeah. How did you decide what your identity meant? And was that like something that you thought about when you were a kid? Was it something that you sort of came into as an adolescent? Like, how have you explored your own identity over time?
You know, I was aware of it from you know, my first memory, or, you know, it was never not a thing. It wasn't like it's not like a construct or something that I decided that I would sort of be interested in. It's, mm-hmm, like my dad is Native and he's from Oklahoma, and we'd go back and see family in Oklahoma on school breaks, and he speaks Cheyenne, so he spoke some in the home. He didn't teach us because it was a little bit more of a time of assimilation then. But my mom's white, so I'm biracial, and That means I have to figure out what being both means and sort of not belonging to either side. So it's, you know, it's something that it's a complex thing. And it's always, I think it's always going to be that, and it's always been that.
I think, is it your character, Dean Oxendine, who thinks of himself as looking ambiguously non-white?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, being in the Bay Area, there's actually plenty of biracial people and people that are mixes of different things. And but you still get asked, like, what are you? The question comes up because it's not, people don't really know what the range, the dynamic range of what Native people can look like is, because a lot of people don't even know Native people. And there's a monolithic historical version of what it's, what we're supposed to look like. And that...
like Iron Eyes Cody, who is not Native.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's usually something stereotypical or a headdress or, you know, there are certain high cheekbones. It's this ridiculous thing that there's one certain way that we're supposed to look. And generally within the community, we know what we look like and we know the range. And So
when you would leave Oakland and go with your dad and visit his family in Oklahoma, was there a sense that they were tied into your culture in a different way than you were?
I think there's definitely, I mean, I didn't really get this, but there's definitely a tension between reservation natives and natives from the city regarding authenticity and what makes you more native or less native. There's sort of that tension. For me, they're all kind of childhood memories of just seeing aunties and grandmothers. And I was just back there not that long ago. My sister lives there now, and so does my dad. So I think I answered your question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah. So you set the book in Oakland where you grew up. And it feels very much like a trip through this city. Like, people may not know Oakland, but it feels very much like on the ground. Like, you're talking about streets and neighborhoods and areas of the city. And I want to talk about the title of the book, which comes from the Gertrude Stein quote, "There is no there there." And this is something that you've given a lot of thought to over time.
Well, I think... not only has the urban Indian story not really been in the media or in books, but Oakland hasn't. Oakland's kind of, you know, there's Jack London and there's Gertrude Stein, and the only thing she wrote about it is that she didn't write about it. Or, you know, her "there is no there there" line is referring to, in everybody's autobiography, somebody's asking her, why doesn't she write about Oakland? She says, "There is no there there." And she's just she means the land that she grew up on when she was a kid was developed over. So there was no more there to write about. A lot of people have used it to say that now it's like a buzzword in the news to talk about how it's a non-issue or something. But people have used it to talk down about Oakland, like there is no distinction or soul or character to Oakland. And so it's almost more of a response to those people who have misused Gertrude Stein's quote to talk about how Oakland doesn't have a character. And I wanted to write about the place that I'm from. That's my home. I just love it there, and I couldn't find any novels about Oakland. So,
the first character that you introduced to us is Tony Loneman, who is a young man who's affected by fetal alcohol syndrome, and he's aware of this and aware that his physical appearance tells people that there's something different about him. But he's also really aware that he sort of reads people well. And he's got this kind of defiance about him. Can you tell us a little bit about what went into making that character?
You know, I think Native stories and Native history is something that most people don't want to have to look at. And so he sort of stands in as a metaphor for Native history and the idea that it makes people uncomfortable just to talk about it sometimes. And that's what's been exciting about this book being so well received, is that normally people don't want to talk about it, or they want to remember, you know, the version of history that is more convenient.
Did you imagine that the book would find an audience outside the native? I mean, obviously, you're a gifted writer. You were training for years, but did you think about yourself writing for a native audience, a non-native audience? Did you just not even think about that as you were writing?
So I got my MFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts, and I spent 3 years writing the book outside of the program and then 3 years in the program. And I was aware that I could get a teaching job if I had a book. So I thought maybe I could make it, maybe it could be a book. And I would love to teach writing was sort of the goal. So I thought maybe within the native writing community, that would be who might end up reading it. I wasn't thinking that like one day this will get, you know, this will reach whatever. Like I was thinking the native world would be interested in what I'm writing about because that's normally how it goes.
Is there anything you would have done differently had you known that you would have this level of readership and success with your first novel?
I think if somebody would have had a crystal ball and shown me what it would mean, I might hesitate.
Hesitate to write it?
Yeah, I don't know what that exactly means. I don't regret writing it or it being a book. I think it just comes with a lot that I didn't realize would be a part of my life.
Like now you're the spokesman for an entire multi-million person group of individuals?
Yeah, and there's so many different... the thing is, you know, I'm writing a story from a perspective,
right.
And there are over 575 tribes around the country, all with very distinct cultures and languages and histories and contemporary situations. My biggest hope about its success is that publishers will pay attention to other Native writers and know that our books can do well and people want to hear our stories. I certainly wouldn't want me to become the new monolith, you know. I certainly don't want to be that.
There are so many characters that are really compelling in this. I really loved Orville, who's a boy who has found himself. He has this kind of compulsion to dance, to do powwow dancing, and he's found this regalia like in his grandmother's closet and tried it on, and he's almost like he's afraid she's going to catch him because he doesn't quite feel right wearing it. And there were interesting parallels there for me, between Orville's situation of trying this identity and not being sure about it, and kids who maybe have been afraid that they would be found to be gay or transgender or something that feels like part of them, but they're not sure if they can show it to the world.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in this novel has a different proximity and to what being Native is or how they feel about it. And his mom, his grandma, doesn't necessarily want to teach him and also expresses that he doesn't need to know information or be taught some particular culture for him to be Indian. She says in there, you're Indian because you're Indian because you're Indian. But tradition certainly plays a role. Everyone's going to a powwow. And I put in powwows as sort of the central setting or where everyone's going to end up because I feel powwows and the urban Indian experience have parallels because they're very intertribal.
Mm-hmm.
So cities tend to be intertribal. But it's also a place where... you see sort of, I have a line in there about Indians dressed up as Indians. So I think there's always going to be a struggle and a tension between how to be authentic and what does that look like and how to continue to be contemporary and to adapt to, you know, modern life and still feel Indian. Because if you need it to be in the past, then, you know, you're on your way to disappearance.
Yeah. Like you're wearing a T-shirt and I guess jeans, and that's how you dress, and you don't necessarily need to wear something that people would have worn 100 years ago.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's actually an A's shirt, and it was designed by a native artist from Oakland, and it's done. It was at the Native American Heritage Night at the Oakland Coliseum. The day actually we got back from the tour, there was the Heritage Night at the Coliseum, so I saw powwow dancers on the field, which was a surreal moment.
Hmm. My guest is novelist Tommy Orange. His novel is called There, There. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Tommy Orange about his book, There, There. It's a story made up of chapters that feature 12 interconnected characters, and their stories are told as short stories in the novel. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Just so we're clear, Tommy, can you explain for people who aren't familiar with a powwow what it is?
A lot of people do it because it's a dance competition. It's not always thought of that way. But dancers, the way to get dancers to a powwow and have a big powwow is to have a lot of prize money. And some people travel, you know, half the year going to different powwows and trying to win money. But people also make jewelry there, and there's different types of native art that's sold, and there's different types of native food. And so people go and they either watch or they're dancing, and there's a big drum, and there's singing. So that's kind of what it is. Sometimes it's 2 days, sometimes it's one full day.
You mentioned that they are very intertribal, and you also mentioned, and I mentioned that your dad has Cheyenne and Arapaho membership. How did you understand the difference between your Cheyenne side and your Arapaho side as a kid?
I'm actually not Arapaho.
Forgive me. But do I have that wrong?
It's confusing.
Okay. I want to understand, so if you don't mind explaining.
No, I don't mind explaining at all. So part of, you know, when you say that you're Native, you usually want to qualify it with something. This is the history of people questioning it. And people actually, you know, faking it, like Iron Eyes Cody or Elizabeth Warren.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
So that's where I'm enrolled. But we're Cheyenne. We know that we're Southern Cheyenne specifically. There are Northern Cheyennes in Montana and Wyoming. So we're Southern Cheyenne. We just happen to band together as two tribes. And that's, you know, there's federally recognized tribes. And they all have these different names. But most Native people will know specifically what tribe they are.
So there are people of different backgrounds, like Elizabeth Warren, who maybe have a small amount of Native heritage somewhere in the background. Often I think people feel proud of this, and they think that it is respectful of Native culture to sort of claim that as part of their identity. How does that make you feel?
I think I tend to be more inclusive when it comes to who can say they're Native. That being said, if you didn't grow up with any relatives or with the experience, not having a parent or, like I said, any relatives, and you find out when you're, I don't know, 50, whatever years old, because of a DNA test, I don't think that you have much right to claim it. I mean, it's fine that people can find out and take their DNA tests. That's fine. But to sort of double down like she did about Donald Trump's $1 million bet is, you know, it just stoops to his low, and at the expense of, I mean, for some people, it's a very personal issue, and it's a complicated one. So she sort of makes it more complicated and almost kind of a joke, or she's sort of using something that's serious for a lot of people for whatever. I don't even know what she's doing. It's frustrating and unfortunate, and I hope that whole thing just goes away.
You give us a character in the novel, Blue, who is adopted by a white family and sort of raised as a white girl, and then really wants to explore who she is. And it was interesting to think about the thought exercise that you went through trying to imagine what this would feel like.
Yeah, so I mean, this is another layer of complexity to the whole idea of who can identify, because as I just said in my own definition, you need to have the experience or have a parent or a relative. And in Blue's situation, she's full-blooded Native, but she was raised in a white family. And I've known people like this. And So that was just me trying to explore, you know, with all these characters, a range of experiences and what it means for different people.
Do they all carry an aspect of you? I don't know. Is your creative process, does it feel like sort of discovering facets of your own experience and then giving life to them by building them out? Or what is the relationship between how you have seen the world and the perspective you give your characters?
Well, I tend to, they all resemble me more than they resemble real people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things I love about writing and fiction in particular is the way you can, like you just said, thought experiment. I think it's another way of thinking for me. And so there, these different characters I have, you know, gone through various kinds of, maybe I have parallels with them and have thought the things they've thought. And, you know, as you think with characters in a novel, I think it helps the reader and people to understand better what people go through, to sort of walk in their shoes. And I think novels can help build empathy in a way that other forms of writing cannot.
I feel like you wrote with such extraordinary empathy about Jackie Redfeather, who is, I don't want to spoil things for people, but she's got relationships to some of the other characters in the novel, and she's struggling with trying to stay sober. And the way you write about how hard that is and how she's sort of come through it and then fallen back into it is really interesting. And I wonder how you thought about what it would feel like to not be able to stop drinking.
I think, like with all of these characters, I think this is what fiction is made of. You just wonder what it would be like, and then you start to write about it. And in the revision process, at least for me, you find out what feels more true. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's a mysterious thing.
You just know what feels true.
Yeah, as you revise. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some lines just come out of nowhere, and I'm like, I don't know where that came from. And that might stay in, and other lines need work and take years to get to the right place.
So there are 12 characters that merit their own chapter in the story. Is there something significant about that number?
No, and there were many more, actually.
Many more?
Yeah, over the 6-year period, there were probably like 30 or 40 that got cut on the cutting floor.
Are they all still out there in your brain?
I don't think of them, but they're in a folder, and it's a very messy folder that has many folders within it.
Mm-hmm. It's a metaphor right there. All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. Paul is calling from Dallas. Hello, Paul.
Hi. Yes, I certainly am enjoying this conversation. Thank you for it. I'm wondering, author, if the sense that other people have, non-native people have of Oakland, if that has affected, or to what extent it has affected your sense of Oakland? Tortured question. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. Hey, Paul. Let me just make sure I'm getting the question right. You're saying, does my vision of Oakland, is it affected by the way outsiders think of Oakland, or?
Yes. Yes.
No, I mean, I think there definitely are misperceptions about Oakland, and it's changed over the many years. But for me, it's home, and I sort of compartmentalize the way people think of Oakland and then Oakland that I know, and they're just totally separate things. It doesn't change the way I think of Oakland.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. A lot of these characters are separated in some way from a parent, and it made me think about the way that reverberates with so much history, where families were torn apart.
I wanted to show... There's a term that came around maybe a decade ago, maybe longer, called historical trauma. I don't know if you've heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in mental health at a Native American health center in Oakland for almost a decade. And sort of have been able to see just over the course of my life and working in the community, the many ways that history plays out over time. And one of those ways is families not being together for various different reasons, maybe having to do with addiction or poverty or... So I wanted to show, for that reason, I wanted to show history's effects on families now and what it looks like, what alternative family situations you end up with, but also exploring, I grew up with both my parents. They got divorced when I was 13, but your connection to your parents and to your family is a big part of the way you form your identity and the way you think of yourself in the world. So I just wanted to explore the many different iterations of that in the Oakland Native community and what that can look like.
How did your parents, when they were married, and I don't need all the details of their divorce, I'm not plumbing for that, but how did they talk about the ways that they were different culturally?
So my mom... met my dad in northern New Mexico in the 70s. She was sort of a wandering hippie, and he was he had gone up to learn ceremony from a Pueblo guy. And this is Native American church, which is peyote ceremony. So they met in that context, and eventually they lived in Oklahoma for a while, eventually came out to Oakland, and by that time my mom had become evangelical Christian, and my dad had continued to be a Native American church member, and he'd be gone often on weekends. So this was actually a big source of fights, because according to evangelical Christianity, peyote use was sort of this demonic thing. And so I was aware of this cultural difference. There's not that much, white culture is not necessarily a thing. It's sort of the dominant culture or the default, maybe. But being Cheyenne or being Native is a distinct thing. It's not just a default. So I was always aware of this inherent conflict, and also lots of fighting happened in the house, and there was a religious piece to it, and also, like, having a white mother and Indian father, with what history has been, there's an inherent conflict there that I just felt was a part of our life, our family.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Did you feel like you had to, after they were living apart, did you feel like you had to be a different version of yourself depending on who you were staying with?
No. I never, divorce is hard on every kid.
Yeah.
But that wasn't part of it for me. I never felt like it changed me in that way.
So you mentioned that you worked in mental health at, is it Indian Health Service?
It's the Native American Health Center is the name of it.
Okay. You were collecting stories there, right? I mean, not maybe deliberately, but you were hearing a lot of people's experiences.
Yeah, and I actually did a storytelling project there. And I worked for many years as a digital storytelling facilitator out of a nonprofit in Berkeley called Story Center. And you go and teach non-writers how to write compelling 3-minute personal stories, and then how to use digital editing software. And they come up with 3-minute videos that are usually used, usually communities that are underrepresented, and they use these stories to kind of get positive messaging and their stories out in the world.
What an extraordinary experience for a novelist.
It was. I loved the work. I wish I could still do it, but now I'm doing this.
So Opal, who is Orville's grandmother and is raising him and his two brothers, her mother was adamant that they had to kind of own their stories and tell their stories. And Opal grows up and sort of moves away from that. And I feel like you write very sensitively about her. Like, she's worn out. She's got these three kids that are really her grand nephews that she's taking care of. She's got a lot going on. And And it's sort of understandable why maybe she feels like this is not one more thing that she can incorporate into her life. But did it feel different writing about a character who had moved away from at least an outward expression of her Native identity?
I think, I don't think I knew it at the time, but in retrospect, I think it was me trying to figure out why our dad didn't teach us the language, or what are the complicated reasons why we wouldn't have been, you know, he was an engineer at the Lawrence Berkeley Labs, and he worked full time, and if you don't have two language speakers in the house, it's a lot of work to, you know, to try to get all your kids speaking the language. So I think I wanted to understand better why we didn't have a more formative cultural education. And I, you know, I've found out over time that it's complicated and related to pain and his own childhood growing up in Oklahoma. There was a lot of pain attached to his experience. So I think through Opal, I was exploring how would that end up happening, or why would she have feelings like she doesn't necessarily want them to have to learn one way to be Indian or let them figure it out? And he kind of had that approach. He let us all figure it out for ourselves. And also, you know, a lot of what it means to be Cheyenne is so embedded in his way of being that he knew it would be transmitted without having to do anything.
How do you think your life would be different if you were fluent in Cheyenne?
I can't even imagine. You know, so much of culture is embedded in language, and my sister just became fluent, and I'm slowly moving toward trying to understand the language better. But I can't imagine what it would be like. I would be a totally different person.
Yeah, especially for someone who traffics in words and in sort of understanding people through the way that they speak and through writing about them. Is there a Cheyenne phrase that you're aware of that you're like, that is something really important?
I'm just starting to get into it, and I'm working on an autobiographical family novel, and I want the Cheyenne language to be kind of a character, and so I'm studying it for those types of things. But I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, I don't have one on hand, but there are things that I'm studying about it already that are super interesting and will be in the novel.
My guest is novelist Tommy Orange. His critically acclaimed debut book is called There, There. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAthink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. The conversation, of course, is with novelist Tommy Orange. We're talking about his book, There, There. You can also find us on Twitter @KERAthink. I want to talk about Edwin, who's this character who grows up knowing he is of Native heritage, but he's raised by his white mother, so he doesn't even know sort of what form that Native heritage takes. And how do you own an identity then when you can't sort of differentiate yourself from, you know, millions of other people?
And I think the answer is you can't own it, and it's almost like the struggle becomes a part of your identity. Huh. The struggle to not have an identity is sort of part of, this is just so tied into your identity. So, this was, again, sort of trying to think through what it would be like, because I haven't necessarily known anyone like that, like Edwin. So I wanted to think through a character that that had that relationship, that specific relationship to his Native identity.
And if you learn, you know, in your mid to late 20s, like, is it too late to really own that?
Yeah, I mean, in Edwin's case, he is reunited with his father. And I don't think it's too late. And, you know, it's like twins separated at birth and them finding out how many things they have in common. I think there are things that automatically get passed down that are not necessarily, this goes against my earlier definition about experiential, what defines, how do you define being Native or what makes you authentic? And I think there's always exceptions, and that would be one of them. Because if he finds his father and he starts a relationship with him and learns all these things that he's the same as his father even though he never knew him, then that then means that there are things that get passed without experience or having that relative in your life.
Well, I think one of the reasons that I'm drawn to the way you told these stories with these 12 characters who come from different situations and sort of approach their identities from different perspectives is that there isn't really one perfect definition. Like, the reality is it's complicated, and it's going to be complicated by the specifics of someone's individual life.
Yeah, and I think as a culture, as a country, we need to find more nuanced ways to talk about it. You know, we had a biracial president who was the first black president. And by 2042, according to, I don't know how they run these numbers, I think based on the census, whites are going to be the minority in this country. And so where we have to find ways to talk about what all these mixes mean in a way that doesn't dismiss people, but also doesn't give too much credence to people that are trying to claim something that they're not. It's tough. I mean, in the book, I write about blood quantum, and I make the metaphor that Saddam Hussein had had the Quran written in his own blood, and when he died, scholars couldn't decide whether to. It was a sin to have written the Quran in blood, but it's also a sin to destroy any Quran. So they're stuck with it, and that's sort of what blood quantum is. It was something that the U.S. government came up with at the Virginia colony, having to do with if you were half Native, you couldn't get the services that a white person would get, and so they created it to, you know, in this negative light, and then eventually handed it over to tribes to figure out. So it's every tribe has a different blood quantum requirement. Mine is a quarter. There's Cherokees have a descendancy thing. Different tribes have an eighth. Some are a little more like intense and have half. So it's a messy thing.
I wonder what you do with that, recognizing that maybe this means your grandchildren won't belong.
Yeah. I mean, I could see it, very much playing out that, if my grandchildren can't enroll, How does that affect identity when you can't enroll? Technically, somebody could be from four different tribes, or let's say eight different tribes with quarter blood quantum requirements, that thereby being full blooded Indian, and they can't enroll in any tribes. This is a bad situation to have, but I don't quite have any answers as to what to do about it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also find us online at KERA, find us on Twitter at KERA Think. Let's speak with Roger, it looks like, in Schulmanburg. Hi, Roger.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Mr. Orange, I heard an interview with you earlier, I think on NPR, and I'm anxious to read your book. I'm 65. I just turned. I'm about to retire. I've wondered for years what would be an appropriate way to get in touch and to get in some sort of relationship to some Native group or Native people. I wonder how to do that unobtrusively as a non-Native.
In what regard, exactly?
Mostly, from what I know of Native spirituality and relation to the earth, I feel in kinship with that and in harmony with that. I'd like to know more and whatever sort of unity can be forged across non-Native, Native boundaries.
Okay, thanks, Roger. What about that?
Well, I think the internet is a great source. Most major cities, I don't think this is true in Texas, most major cities have Indian centers, and there tend to be events that anyone is welcome to. And I don't know exactly what Roger is looking for, but that's a good place to start. You just Google Indian Center or Native American Center near me, or, you know, I know this is only Texas, so it's not really that relevant, that information, but that would be how I would start if I was in his shoes.
No disrespect whatsoever to Roger's question, but he did mention a connection to the land. And this is something that you both embrace and bristle at when people probably non-Native people assume that Native Americans are tied to the land in a particularly fundamental way.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the many damaging sort of stereotypes, or, you know, it's sort of corny, even though, you know, I know that it's true. And now more than ever, do we need to think of Earth as home, and that we belong here, and that we, there's an old Christian idea about holding dominion over the Earth, and that's very much plays out in our relationship with, as we've seen, with sort of exploiting the Earth. So it's a valid way of thinking, and lots of Native people think that way, but there's a corny version of it that, like, the only way to, and it's sort of dismissive version of it. And this is mostly in relation to urban Indians. It's like, if you aren't on the land, then you're not really Indian. And this is also has to do with relating to Oakland as environment and as land also. It's filled with concrete and metal and glass and wires, but it's still the land. I mean, the Ohlone people were the tribe that would have lived here many years ago, and I know Ohlone people that live in Oakland now.
You mentioned earlier the "what are you" question, which I just can't imagine that it can be asked in a way that is not really offensive. But do you ever just pretend you don't understand what people mean when they ask you that?
No, but like I was saying earlier, I always know that something offensive is coming after I say that I'm Native. Like 90% of the time, the response to me saying I'm Native tends to be offensive in various different ways.
Like deliberately offensive?
Not always, but offensive questions that are out of ignorance. So it becomes sort of an educational opportunity if I'm feeling especially positive that day, or it just always becomes a thing. Or I shut down and I walk away, or, you know, it's different responses over time.
My guest is novelist Tommy Orange. We're talking about his critically acclaimed book. It's called There, There. It's his debut novel. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Did your father try to prepare you for the stupid things people say to a kid who looks Native American?
No. He really didn't. He very much wanted us to feel pride in being Native and to know that who we come from. That was never not a thing. Just recently, actually, I was telling him. So I got a chapter from the novel was in the New Yorker, and that got fact checked by the New Yorker, and which was kind of a weird experience.
They fact check fiction.
In my case, I think they maybe were wondering what were the autobiographical elements, and that particular chapter happens to closely resemble my experience and family. I reference the family that I'm referencing in that chapter is mine, and my family knows that, and they've read it. And so they got a hold of somebody because I referred to my dad being on a reservation in Oklahoma, and it's not technically reservations there. It's tribal jurisdiction land. That's not... sort of like to say reservations is shorthand. People understand what you're talking about. And my dad's even referred to himself growing up on the reservation, even though it's not the reservation. The conditions are very similar, and it's, you know, it's a land base where lots of Cheyenne people are. But when they were fact-checking, they got a hold of a university professor at Oklahoma University. I'm not sure which one. And the fact-checker told me that this woman, Native American studies person that that he talked to said, I don't think this author has met a single Native American person in their life, solely because I said reservations about Oklahoma, even though there's no technical reservations.
Wow.
So I told my dad that, and he got he wanted me to find out who they were, like he was going to go after them. So,
because he's protective of you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was the first. I mean, that was the first time he's ever done that before. Expressed that kind of sentiment. It was a nice moment.
Was your family excited for this book to come out?
Yeah, they've been incredible, and when I've talked to them about doing this autobiographical one, they're all really into it. They don't mind me. I mean, I'm going to fictionalize it and divert in ways that didn't happen. That's what I like about fiction. But they're happy for our story to be out there. It was a hard-earned one, so sort of like should do something with it.
I don't want to talk specifically about the ending of the novel, but I wonder if you've heard from people who have expressed surprise, frustration, satisfaction with the way, the very dramatic way the story ends.
Yeah, I've heard a range of different reactions. I think, interestingly, the Native reaction has been very positive, from Oakland Natives to Natives all over the country. I think people are just seeing themselves reflected in literature and in a way that they haven't read before. But the white reaction, especially to the ending, is just sort of like disappointment and like, why does it have to be so sad? So it's interesting.
Does that make you want to strangle somebody?
I try to explain that, you know, these are real elements from people's lives that happen, and to dismiss it as just sad is it's just reductive and not very intelligent, and it's more a reflection of your own emotional maturity or something if that's all you got from it was that it was sad. I mean, I prefer maybe tragic has a grander scope to it. So it's definitely frustrating because a lot of my biographical details are in the characters. So it's like calling me sad, which is a super sad thing to have to hear from someone.
Do you feel like, I mean, I have to imagine that there have been Native Americans who have been writing for a very long time now and telling their stories and sharing their stories, but maybe the sort of broader publishing industry wasn't that interested in giving these books a place?
Yeah, there's been these waves. So after the Civil Rights Movement and the occupation of Alcatraz, there was a wave of what they called at the time the Native American Renaissance. And then that died down and less books were coming out. And you can sort of see this over time. And then in the 90s, I think because of Dances with Wolves, there was another resurgence. And there's one happening now, which sort of coincided with what happened at Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when it comes into the public consciousness, people are interested. I just hope that it's not a wave, but something that, you know, continues to be paid attention to and listened to.
The new book by novelist Tommy Orange is there. Tommy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Yeah, thank you.
You can find us on Twitter at KERA Think and subscribe to the podcast using whatever app you use to get your podcasts. If you want to know about upcoming shows, check out think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.